Yes, indeed. It's Sandeep Burman again. He's been introduced. You know him.
And my resume hasn't changed since the morning. I think we're good.
You can read his resume in your folder. He's a great guy. And he knows a lot of things, and he's going to tell you about some of them right now. Now comes the part of the show where you kind of look into the future a little bit.
Well, thank you everyone for coming back for the afternoon. And I did tell you that this morning I would tell you a little bit more about myself for the afternoon talk. But all I wanted to say is that I'm a relative newcomer to Superfund. My Superfund story is only about 3 years old, so it's a little intimidating to come in on the heels of practitioners who have been at this for such a long time, and then many of you in the audience have been working in Superfund for a long time. And I think I represent many of us, though, that are relatively new to Superfund, and this is just a function of the fact that there's 4 generations in the Minnesota workforce currently, and I think Superfund spans all of those 4. So for us, we come to Superfund and we look back at this proud history, this great legacy, and it's definitely with a sense of humility that we realize that we're standing on the shoulders of giants. And on us falls the responsibility, though, of looking ahead, because there are changes coming, and maybe significant changes coming. I won't go so far as to say any of the laws will be changing, but definitely the working landscape is changing. And Superfund, in order to stay relevant, which it does need to stay relevant, is going to have to make some changes too. So today I hope I can share with you some of the changes that at least I see coming, and I have consulted with many of my coworkers, and it's a sort of a consensus view, so it's not just my ramblings of what's coming next. So maybe that's going too far. I don't know if Caterpillar is about to launch its new line just anytime soon, but the other things that I wanted to share with you are not as fanciful as this. They really are sort of a top 10 list of the changes that we think will influence Superfund in the years to come. At number 10, what we're going to see, and we're beginning to see this, is really a need to balance public health risks with ecological risks. And this has to do with the fact that Superfund, over its history, really has had sites, major sites, that have been driven by ecological risk, as well as another family of sites that have been driven by public health risks. Of late, public health risks have dominated, and they're, if not exactly tension, but there's obviously been a little bit of competition, a little bit of challenge to manage resources, making sure that public health risk that has to do with things like vapor intrusion, drinking water issues, get addressed, and resources are set aside for that. And to some extent, ecologically driven sites have a little bit been set aside, not ignored, but prioritized differently. What we're seeing now is a different situation where there is resources that are coming in to the ecological side of things, driven by the need to redevelop, revitalize on a regional scale certain areas, even if this is just for continued natural use and green space. We have factors coming into play, such as the Clean Water Legacy Fund that has pumping a lot of money into restoration purposes. And all of this is leading to reassessments that are discovering legacy pollution in areas that perhaps have no public health risk, but there is a premium now back on restoring these areas. And that is going to result, it already is resulting in major assessments and potentially cleanups of large areas with an effort to revitalizing some of these areas. And the linkages are a lot of different factors, everything from you have environmental justice, you have a desire to revitalize local economies, you have a desire to just improve the quality of life. And there's a lot of assessment and monitoring that is taking place across the state of surface waters. And that is leading to the discovery of some of these issues. And we will see, in the opinion of many of us, a resurgence of these larger ecologically driven cleanups. And where that is important, not just so far as managing resources between these two families of Superfund, the public health-driven sites and the ecologically driven sites, but there's a great need to maintain the knowledge base and the skill set that goes into large-scale environmental cleanups. Things like characterization and cleanup of sediments, ecological risk assessment, some of these skills do need to be maintained and kept current. So we do need a workforce that will still be able to practice in the field of the large ecologically driven cleanups. Number nine, we have increased community engagement. The picture I have at the bottom is the Children of Love Canal. This was a protest that some of the neighborhoods had to resort to try and get attention to the tragedy that was playing out at Love Canal. So we've come a long ways since then. The other pictures that I have here are of Hans Navy and Jim Kelly. This is taken from the MPCA Facebook page. The MPCA has a Facebook page, which probably illustrates my point as to how communications have changed. And the other picture I have is a graphic of a page that we have on the major cleanup that's happening at the Southeast Como neighborhood. And it kind of lays out the MPCA's roadmap and plans for the site. The blue bar at the bottom is community engagement. And as you can see, it runs throughout the entire stages that the site is going to go through, as opposed to in the past where public engagement really was done at specific milestones at these sites. What we're increasingly moving to, and it's not just in this one site, I just found a handy graphic, so I used it, but there's about a dozen sites where this community engagement is it's an ongoing, interactive, continuous process. It's no longer something we do at select milestone events. And this is driven by a definite upsurge in the interest that community groups, neighborhoods, citizens, elected officials, everybody has in what's happening with investigation cleanup at contaminated sites. There's much greater awareness of the environmental health risks. There's concerns about the future of the community, about the aspiration of the neighborhoods, about property values, environmental justice issues, overall quality of life, and there's a lot more ready access to information. Given all of that and the profusion of social media, we're seeing a different paradigm where the interaction with the public, with stakeholders, is ongoing and continuous, and it really has to be offered up in multiple platforms. It's not just the periodic public meetings or the press announcements. We are now doing availability sessions. We're doing a lot of social media things, a lot of public meetings. And that obviously affects many of you in the room that are working on these sites in different capacities. These are not things that we learn at school or learned at school, and curriculums are perhaps still not where they should be in terms of this aspect of our profession, which is really getting the message out. But this is an absolutely critical need, and it dominates a lot of our time and energy and resources, as I'm sure it does for many of you that are working on some of these larger projects. So this enhancement of community engagement and involvement is here to stay. Number eight is a renewed emphasis on groundwater and drinking water protection. While this has always been a cornerstone of Superfund, there is unquestionably a heightened focus on the long-term sustainability of groundwater and drinking water in Minnesota and nationwide. It's very clear that there will be pressures and constraints on groundwater and drinking water in the years ahead, and conservation and protection are very much in focus now. So the early detection, monitoring, cleanup, investigation of industrial chemicals and drinking water supplies is no exception, and the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Agriculture has begun to partner and will do even more so in the future, Department of Health, to react much more sooner to the detections of contaminants in public water supplies. So this will result in earlier source investigations, monitoring efforts, better to understand where is the contamination coming from, how much is the impact likely to be on the public water supply, well before we get to a point where you have a standard exceeded, which used to be the model in the past. Typically, response actions got triggered once there was a formal exceedance in the public water supply. We are having to engage farther upstream, so to speak, at this point, and be proactive and try to not let the standard be exceeded. So you'll see more of this, and these efforts, again, will reach out and probably involve a lot of you that are in this room in your professions, whether it's with consulting firms or local governments, because the public water suppliers do play a major role in our efforts to be more proactive as far as making sure that drinking water supplies are protected for the long term. Number seven is the growing importance of voluntary responsible parties. Merlin CERCLA have always offered three basic tracks. You have responsible parties who are brought to the table through formal enforcement is perhaps too harsh a word, but in essence, that's what the process has been of naming responsibility parties, engaging with them, and bringing them to the table. There's also been the voluntary track available for parties who may choose to avail of that. And the parties then work with the regulatory agency through specific arrangements, and they don't get listed on state or federal superfund. So that track has always been available. It might have been a little bit underutilized, or perhaps it bled into the third track, which was reserved for voluntary parties doing redevelopment. So at the MPCA, a couple years ago, we tried to tease these two apart. So tease voluntary responsibility parties apart from the true voluntary parties who were redevelopment focused, and try to engage with the voluntary responsibility parties in a more streamlined collaborative effort without subjecting them through the formal Superfund process. The idea being that we could speed up actually getting the work started, as opposed to the front-end negotiation and discussions and sometimes adversarial relationships that mark the engagement of a responsible party to the formal Superfund process. So it's a process that has worked well. It's just about 2 years old. We initially offered this up through the development of what we were calling cooperative cleanup memorandums, which were a one-size-fits-all agreement for these voluntary ERPs, as opposed to the more tedious site-specific agreements that were practiced prior to that. In 2014, actually earlier this year, we simplified it even farther. We started offering the voluntary responsible party track right as part of the application to enroll in the voluntary remediation programs, which is the pathway that voluntary parties enter the brownfield programs. We essentially just modify that to allow voluntary responsible parties to come in, same process, and do remediation work as opposed to just doing redevelopment work. And we also simplified the fee structure. So you pay the same rate as you do for enrolling in the VIC program, as you do for a voluntary responsible party now, and you're enrolling in a PCA program to get oversight of remediation work. The idea again here is that let's spend the time on doing the work, and let's get started on the work sooner as opposed to the preliminary upfront negotiations that seem to consume a lot of time and resources. Number six is perhaps not something that's totally unique. It's the aspect of coordinating remediation with redevelopment. The traditional model has been that remediation needs to be completely done and site delisted and so on and so forth before you could do redevelopment. And Paul Hyde touched on some of those traditional issues that crop up when you try to work on a NPL or a PLP site that's still actively listed, that's still actively undergoing remediation. The norm used to be all that had to be done and wrapped up nicely before you could bring to bear on it all the resources and help you needed to get redevelopment going. What we're seeing now, though, is that the easy brownfields are mostly all done, and you're now getting into the second generation of redevelopment. These are the tougher sites where there are issues that are lingering that were never really cleaned up. So the redevelopment process is running into these issues that are still part of that first cycle of cleanup, but were not dealt with. Or the redevelopment process is running into new issues such as vapor intrusion, which were simply not a consideration the first time around. So now you if you want to redevelop the sites, you can't really wait for remediation to come in. Oftentimes there are no responsible parties, so that involves the state coming in and doing its thing. And government try as it might, can government really move at the speed of business? I do not know. We try our best, but some things are perhaps not that difficult to accomplish. So what we're seeing now is remediation, redevelopment occurring more in parallel as opposed to the traditional model where they happen in a series fashion. And this involves responsible parties, voluntary parties, MPCA, EPA, all working at the same time on these sites. Now, this involves a mindset shift because these were not dynamics that were really practiced before. Everybody, it was more of an assembly line. You came in, you did the cleanup, whoever was doing that, and then the site was deemed free and clear for redevelopment. And that model is not going to allow us to redevelop some of the sites that we're coming across. So we are beginning to see, and we're adjusting as our responsible parties and voluntary parties, and my one lawyer joke of the day, attorneys too, are making those adjustments. And so what we're seeing is a change in different kind of more innovative partnerships, changes in timelines, changes in process, even changes in some of the cleanup technologies to allow remediation, redevelopment, all to happen in tandem as opposed to happening in a sequential fashion. Number five is a big issue. This is what I think we all are very well aware of. This is the issue of emerging and re-emerging contaminants. Nationally at EPA and certainly the Department of Health in Minnesota, at the MPC as well, there are very major contaminants of emerging concern programs in place. This slide essentially quotes from the State Department, Minnesota Department of Health's webpage on contaminants of emerging concerns. So I'm not going to read it out. You can read it or go to the MDH's excellent website. But basically, these are contaminants that either have been detected or have the potential for being detected in Minnesota waters based on their occurrence and usage. These are contaminants that are still not well understood, but they are known to have potential impacts on public health. And these are also contaminants that did not really have readily applicable standards to them. So the Department of Health has an active program. Some of it's funded by the Clean Water Legacy Fund, where they are researching these chemicals, as is EPA and Department of Defense. So this is these chemicals show up in all of these different programs. And on Superfund will fall the responsibility as these chemicals become more formally regulated to ensure that there is no public health exposure from these chemicals happening at existing sites and old sites and new sites in Minnesota. So this is a wide range of products, pharmaceuticals, pesticides, personal care products, industrial effluents. And there's many conferences and a lot of good work that's happening, USGS and MDH and others, and I'm sure you've been to conferences where these things are talked about. So I probably don't need to go into a whole lot more detail. So I'll move on to part B of this issue, which is the re-emerging contaminants. So again, whether it's EPA or Department of Health, even some of the very well-known chemicals are periodically reviewed to see if the toxicological information has changed or should be changed. This is an ongoing process, and as a result, you're seeing standards change, usually going lower for some very well-known names in the recent past. TCE, PCE, cadmium, DCA, 1,2-DCE. So these have all been recent revisions downwards, and there is a long list of chemicals that is under review, and we'll wait and see where the new numbers go. But anytime this happens, once again, the burden does fall on all of us to ensure that current sites are now indexed to these new values, because these are the values that are now deemed to be protective of human health. And there's a certain amount of a mandate and responsibility to also go back and ensure that old sites that have been closed, but were closed at much higher levels because some of the standards were much higher even not that long ago, that those continue to be protective. So this is a charge that definitely the MPCA has been made aware of, something that we have to do and we would have done anyway, but there's definitely an impetus to ensure that cleanup standards stay current with evolving science for both new contaminants and old contaminants that now have new standards. So this will impact Superfund for years to come. Number four on the list is the reassessment of closed sites. I just talked about several things that are kind of pointing to this. Some of those factors are redevelopment, the issue of emerging contaminants, we have the standard revision, we have drinking water protection, the emphasis on that, the need to do that, and vapor intrusion, just to name a few of the reasons why reassessment of closed sites is both an expectation and a directive that's been handed down to the MPCA. This is primarily happening through two methods. There are some systematic efforts that we have committed to doing to going back and looking at certain clusters of closed sites driven by the chemical, by receptor groupings, risk priorities, and so on. You'll hear a little bit more details about that in a later talk this afternoon. And this is just at its early stages. We don't have, on the Superfund family of programs, we don't have sites yet that have been identified for actual retesting. What we have is sites that have been identified for at least reviewing the information on to see if there's a need to go back and redrill or retest those sites. We're talking about closed sites in VIC and Superfund and so on. The second way that old sites are being reassessed is really site-specific events driven by new work at these sites, primarily redevelopment, or work at a nearby location where problems are being discovered that are pointing to the fact that some of these sites were not closed at standards that would pass muster today. So you have some very site-specific reassessments, and in some cases even mitigation of some of these older sites that has to be undertaken because those risks were still persistent. Now, this is a tricky issue. People have, you know, depending on who you talk to, there's mixed feelings about this, rightfully so, because reopening old sites is not easy. It's disruptive. It's something, though, that we, especially the folks in this room, we know enough now about some of these risks. It would be remiss not to. So this will happen, and the trick would be to do this in a way that's not disruptive, where you come out with a net gain and you don't end up disrupting a redevelopment effort or something else that was a beneficial reuse. And again, I think Paul Hite talked about some of the risks associated and how imperative it is to manage these old sites in a way that you don't end up stifling something good that was happening at these sites in terms of redevelopment or future benefit to the communities. So the PCS certainly is committed to doing this in a very measured fashion and surgically as opposed to the blunt instrument style. So that's our hope and that's our commitment. And this is something we would be looking for a lot of partnerships to be able to do so effectively. Number three on my list is the increasing number of sites without responsible parties. I just talked about a number of reasons why, how new sites are coming into the Superfund family of programs. And a lot of the sites, just because of the ups and downs of the economy, don't have responsible parties viable anymore, or responsible parties are not able or willing to do the work. And these sites, there's a steady trickle at these sites. These pictures are not from the 80s or the 90s. They're from a site that was discovered just a few months ago. And this is a major enough site that this will require help from US EPA for us to tackle. So these sites are coming in, and again, in some respects, it's work for all of us in the room, and maybe that's a good thing. But it's also indicative of some problems that have persisted for a long time in some of these sites, right under our noses, and we haven't been aware of. So we need to go back, and it's not just a question of doing the superficial cleanup, but we do have to look and see what's happened in the subsurface, because some of these sites have been around for a long time, and there's potential that there's probably significant subsurface contamination that has persisted. So we will continue to see a large proportion of new sites that come into Superfund probably come without responsible parties. And this, of course, puts pressure on resources on the state-funded and federally funded end of things, resources both in terms of funding to tackle these sites and resources both in terms of manpower to take on these new projects. Number two on my list is really the increasing role for the site assessment arm of Superfund. As we have heard this morning, and I talked about it briefly too, site assessment is where sites are triaged or discoveries are triaged. Decisions are made as to whether the sites are serious enough to require work. Decisions are made as to what part of the program they should go to. Decisions are made as to whether or not there's a responsible party. All of this happens in the site assessment arm of Superfund. This was a very active and vibrant portion of the program in the early inception. And as the program matured and most of the sites were discovered and cataloged and pushed through the program, this part of the program was wound down. And now all of a sudden we have a fresh influx of new sites and new issues and the need to go out and reassess old sites, need to go out and reassess some of these new emerging issues. So all of this is again causing a backlog in the site assessment arm of Superfund. And site assessment is not something that MPCA does in a vacuum. We work with contractors, we work with local agencies, we work with the health department. So that, again, puts a pressure on everybody's resources because now there's all of a sudden a significant amount of sites that do need to go through that initial site assessment phase. And I've listed some of the things that site assessment does, the preliminary assessments. A lot of times there are interim actions that are needed because there are ongoing impacts, whether that's impacted water wells or vapor impacts. Site assessment has to go out and take care of those issues while we try to find responsible parties and find a long-term pathway for the site. Things like RP searches, preparing the sites for listing, if that's the right thing to do, and a lot of coordination with EPA. So pretty resource intensive, and right now a portion of the program that is understaffed and under-resourced, but this is something that we're going to have to address as the years go by. And number one on the list is vapor intrusion, which is probably not a surprise to many of you, though I know some folks have expressed surprise that after 10 years of dealing with this, why is it still such a big deal? It does remain a big deal, for many of you in the room, I'm sure it has dominated your professional lives, as it has done for many of us at the PCA. And for those of you that perhaps are wondering what vapor intrusion is, vapor intrusion really happens when you have groundwater contamination that has migrated away from the source area, underlying buildings, and even from low levels of groundwater contamination, you can get significant upward migration of vapors into inhabited structures. And there's a lot of factors which control how far the groundwater moves from the source area, which we probably understand better than why vapors seem to come off these groundwater plumes and enter inhabited spaces. So this, even though intuitively, you know, you all wonder, so what's so new and different about this? And vapor intrusion really has been around ever since the beginning of any of the remediation programs, whether it's Superfund or petroleum, but it was always investigated as a near source phenomena with handheld instrumentation, and we were looking for the acute explosive levels and things like that. And then the focus offsite really wasn't defining the groundwater contamination, dealing with it. This aspect that these offsite groundwater plumes at significant distances away from the source area could still generate vapors and create a whole new impacted media in the soil gas and then create a whole another exposure pathway. This is something that really gained prominence about a decade ago now. And in the last 10 years, we have learned a lot and we have dealt with a lot of these sites. But as we enter the second decade of vapor intrusion, it's very clear that there's a lot of things that need to get resolved. And I have a picture here that shows one of the common methods how vapor intrusion is dealt with, which is through these radon type of systems in homes. So now you have a situation where this whole vapor intrusion thing has, it's no longer in the subsurface, it's no longer a thing of geology or hydrogeology. Vapor intrusion is being confronted with in basements and attics, and that's not something that groundwater hydrogeologists, you know, that's not what we go to school for, but we've been operating in basements and attics now for the last 10 years trying to confront vapor intrusion and deal with it. And we thought that we had it fairly well understood in terms of the technical aspects, in terms of the logistical, legal, communication aspects. But as we enter the second decade, there's a whole lot of questions that are still not quite as well understood as we understood things have to do with groundwater. And I've listed some of them. The fact that the safe concentrations of indoor air are very, very low for some of these chemicals. TC, for instance, and PC as well, it's 2 parts per billion. So those are very low standards that have to be met. So if you have TC or PC in the vapor form entering a residential setting from an underlying groundwater plume, the groundwater plume may no longer pose a risk. There's no exposure to it. But you have to make sure that you're not exceeding 2 parts per billion in the occupied space in the air. And that's a challenge. We're finding that soil gas, which is the media that's getting impacted, the contamination of the soil gas seems to persist for years and decades after the release, even in the case of some of these volatile compounds. We don't really understand the relationship between the contaminant concentration in the soil gas and those in the impacted soil or groundwater. So you can't really base your decisions on vapor intrusion on what you're seeing in groundwater and soil. The relationship with soil gas underneath the structure with the indoor air, again, not very well understood. There's a lot of variability on the scale of days even. Building mitigation versus source remediation. This is the challenge I talked about. Are we going to deal with this thing in the attics or the basements, or are we going to go out and clean up the actual source area in the aquifer to fix these problems on a permanent basis? That's an issue that I think everybody's grappling with. What's the effectiveness of some of these mitigation systems we're putting into buildings? Are they protective for the long term? And what's the infrastructure for monitoring and watching over these things? We have very well developed the schemes that have matured and evolved as far as groundwater contamination. We perhaps don't quite have those approaches fine-tuned for indoor air and vapor intrusion. There are all these other aspects of point of sale notification. How does the message get carried forward that there was a vapor intrusion issue at a building and that there are systems in place, but they do have to be maintained for the long term? Access and communication, that's a whole different issue. Again, most of us, when we went to school for groundwater, did not really go to school for how to communicate to people and tell them that we need access to not just their homes, Vapor intrusion is not a physical, it's not a question of getting access to somebody's well like you might for a drinking water problem. You need access to their indoor air, and that involves getting a lot of access to their lifestyle and understanding what they're doing in their homes so you can tease out what's vapor intrusion versus what's background. And people react very differently when you ask for that kind of access, even though it is to keep them safe, than they do when you want access to sample their front yard or their well. So we are moving into a whole other realm of communication and access that, and it's just not the PC, it affects all of you because many of you work on this site, so you know what I'm talking about. So these are things that have not quite gelled yet, and these issues will keep us busy and thinking for a long time. So that's sort of my top 10, and maybe I have a little bit of time. I'm well, doing good. So I'll tell you about the bonus item, which really, this really was number 11, the aspect I have here with coordinating with EPA. That's really number 11, and this is also my kind of defense when the Letterman attorneys come looking for me. I'll tell them I really had, this really was top 11, so they can leave me alone. But the state's relationship with EPA on federal Superfund, not different from a lot of other states. In the early days, very closely allied with EPA, a lot of NPL listings, a lot of sharing of resources, a lot of asking EPA for resources. State program kind of came into its own. It matured. Like many other states, we felt we could do things cheaper and quicker than EPA. And for the most part, we asked to be left alone. They left us alone. Things have come full circle to a point now, though, where we a little bit need EPA back in the game. We need the resources. We need the horsepower they bring as far as technical know-how. We certainly need the funding. So we're beginning to work a lot more closely with EPA, restoring some relationships, restoring some processes after sort of a gap of a few years. And this is a good thing. EPA is EPA, as we heard this morning, but it's a double-edged sword. If you're operating in Superfund, you do need to work with EPA. EPA has a lot to offer. And we have certainly reached out to them. As I said, we are coordinating a lot with them on the site assessment end of things. We are coordinating a lot with EPA on the NPL sites that are in the state in terms of signing new agreements and reworking old agreements, seeking more assistance, seeking more funding, better defining roles and responsibilities. So a lot more EPA involvement in Minnesota. And this is, again, not just us. This is happening nationally because Superfund definitely is entering a phase of, if not quite revival, but it's very clear that Superfund is something that will be relevant for a number of years. So I think a lot of states are sort of reconnecting with EPA. EPA has a big task on its hand because Congress looks at Superfund with mixed feelings. The resources are not quite there yet for EPA to really beef up its support to the state. They're doing a great job of it, though. They're prioritizing. And we have certainly benefited from the last couple of years of more enhanced coordination with EPA. We haven't listed a site on the NPL for several years, but there's probably a couple of sites that are sort of making their way up in the pipeline, and we might yet have, after a long gap, a couple of new NPL listings from Minnesota. And again, we're doing it because those resources that EPA can provide will help us solve these problems. So that was my bonus item number 11, and I will close, I guess, with a disturbing image from... Well, actually, let me do this. This is the top 10 issues, just to recap. So I won't read them, but they're listed here, sort of from number 10 to number 1. At least from, again, the PCF perspective, just the increasing order of importance. So vapor intrusion, we think, will be a major, major issue that will take up a lot of resources, require a lot of thinking, and require a lot of innovation and a lot of technical improvements in the years ahead. So that's the, for what it's worth, the top 10 from the PCA perspective. And to close, I'll let you enjoy this. This is from that site that was discovered a couple of months ago. It's a 10,000-gallon tank, or part of it. The rest of this tank is full of hazardous waste sludge, but they got creative with the front end of it. So discovery of this more than anything else prompted us to call in EPA for help. So. So I can take questions if I'm
Take maybe
interested.
A couple questions for Sandeep, and then we'll segue right into the sort of a larger. So if any of the other speakers
want to make their way up to the front.
Steve, Mike, I think Alan's still here, I think.
Hey, Sandeep. Would you go back to your top 10 list? When you were at number 10, Jennifer and I had a bet about what number one was going to be. She correctly said vapor intrusion.
What was yours?
But I thought it was going to be money, that we're grossly underfunded and we need money.
Right.
And I didn't see it on your list.
Absolutely. I think money's part of all of this. It almost is the... doesn't need to be almost fleshed out. None of these things, all of these things will require money, absolutely. I think people are just tired of hearing me complain about money. I know at the MPC they are, so I didn't want to bring it up.